Welcome to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show and would like to hear more from us, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform. Welcome to the show, guys. Today we're joined by Ian Venner. Ian Venner is CTO and co-founder of Hurricane Modular Commerce. I mean, it's great to have you join us today, Ian. I'm really, really excited to have a chat with you. I mean, we spoke a little bit before the recording, and my God, I think we're going to have a great conversation. So thanks for taking the time to do this.
No, it's my pleasure. My pleasure.
Cool. So I think, you know, in a nutshell, obviously, you've got a very interesting background in technology. In a nutshell, could you kind of give us a bit of insight into that, just for the listeners' sake?
Sure. I mean, my background sort of originally was electronics and microelectronics, and that's kind of where I started. I was kind of around at the birth of satellite television, developing systems for video decryption, kind of had an interesting career after that, moving from sort of direct electronics into more manufacturing-based systems, and using, you know, genetic algorithms to schedule production lines. Did a big project on that for General Motors and for the Vauxhall Luton plant. And from there, it was I was opportunistic, I think, in my approach to my career. So yeah. I was looking for things that were going to excite me, rather than necessarily, going, oh well, I've done this in manufacturing, I need to now perhaps capitalize on that and move on. I very much looked for another avenue. And from there, I moved into financial services and was involved with quotation portals, doing, you know, multi-quotations, was part of the team that standardized the data formats for comparative quotation engines, which are now used on all the big platforms that everyone will have used. There, I moved into digital media, and did live streaming TV over 2.5G, then into a more digital media on mobile after that, doing a big project for Samsung, launching something that was called their Media Hub across North America. I think it was 150 million devices that went out on. So really interesting stuff. A lot of that work was involved using digital rights management. We were the first people to use it mobile from Microsoft. So we were kind of the people that got Microsoft DRN up and running.
Wow.
Big part of what was known as the ultraviolet digital campaign, which was where you would buy a DVD when people bought DVDs,
yeah,
and you'd also get a little voucher inside your box, which allowed you to download a digital copy, which you could basically keep in the library forever. And we were part of that movement. And then I did a bit of consultancy after that, moved around a little bit. I did an interim role with a ticketing agency, where we were doing direct from artist ticketing. So people like the Foo Fighters and Paul McCartney and Pearl Jam and the likes. And then I did, again, some more consultancy. And then about 5 years ago, I got a call from the guy I worked with at the ticketing agency. And he said, are you interested in looking at what was then described as Project X? And I got sent over a document, which we sort of outlined what we were looking to do, or what they were looking to do at the time, and it just looked interesting. It was a, you know, white piece of paper, didn't have no existing systems, no constraints, and I had free rein to do what I wanted. So it was an ideal situation. So I came on board, and yeah, we founded Hurricane. I think we actually incorporated it just over 4.5 years ago, and I it was actually formally founded about four. So
cool,
yeah, interesting.
Yeah, I mean, what a story that is. I mean, all the stuff you seem to have worked on has been so, like, revolutionary and kind of cutting edge.
Yeah, absolutely. I've always taken an opportunity when it's been presented. And even if I thought that opportunity was sort of, you know, a stretch from where I was, you know, it's always been something that's driven me is that I didn't want to get stuck into a place where I almost felt comfortable.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be in that role where I was kind of, you know, head of systems, and that's what I did, you know, and that was my life. And I stayed with a company or a couple of companies, and I just sort of, you know, managed their systems and services. That just never appealed to me. And big corporate has never appealed to me. I've always worked in small businesses. You know, in fact, I've left businesses when they got too big, just because it becomes too much meetings about meetings, and it kind of can stifle the creativity part and that kind of the interesting bit.
Yeah, massively. I completely agree. I want to hear about what Hurricane Modular Commerce is. What's your product? What's your service?
We're a software as a services platform. We offer a number of APIs to companies ranging from, all the ones I can talk about, ranging from people like Australia Post to Arm Post, who are the Irish Postal Service, a number of other big European posts. We also then work with some of the carriers behind the people. So we work with a big carrier called Seiko Logistics, who are actually the people behind Amazon's deliveries into Australia. And then we work with a lot of what they call aggregating platforms. So platforms where there's a number of shippers who are vying for your business. And what we provide is in kind of two distinct areas. We provide a series of tools for cross-border e-commerce. And one of those areas is providing what I would suggest was probably standard things that most people are aware of, which would be things like duties and tax calculations. Mm-hmm. Now we're in the post-Brexit world. You know, we're all familiar that we're having to pay tax now for importing from Europe. We've got a free trade deal, but that just means we don't pay any duty. Tax is still applicable, and so we calculate that. You know, we calculate the duties and taxes that are required. It's actually a hugely complex set of equations globally. There are nuances and differences almost by country and region. So, you know, it's actually in itself where people say, oh, it's a 20% duty. It you know, that's the easy bit. You know, that probably only accounts for about 60% of the calculation. Some of them are very complex.
Yeah.
We also then do screening of prohibited and restricted goods. So the ones that people are aware of, there's a treaty called CITES, which covers the trade in endangered species. Right. So you can't import ivory. You can't import animal skins. You can't import tortoiseshell. You know, rare woods, you know, so we do that. But then there's a whole host of other things around prohibited and restricted that people wouldn't even think about. Mm. So chemical composition of your lipsticks, you know, whether or not you can export a set of night vision goggles, because a lot of these are considered dual use now. A lot of commodities are dual use. You know, they're seen as both a military and a civilian item. So as soon as you get to a certain standard of night vision, you have to have export controls of item.
Wow,
so
I didn't know that.
It's a very nuanced area, prohibited and restricted. I mean, there's other things just like plain restrictions, which again probably wouldn't crop up to people. So certain perfumes can't be imported into Muslim states because they contain alcohol.
Oh, really?
You have to have oil-based perfumes that go into places like the United Arab Emirates or Saudi Arabia. You can't import your standard Chanel No. 5 because it's got alcohol in it. So yeah, it's kind of interesting. And then the other one we do, kind of if you like, in the standard cross-border, is something called denied party screening. So globally, there are a lot of lists of people that are just not allowed to receive items. So you cannot ship them. You know, somebody's going to be obvious, terrorists. Yeah. You know, some of the Russian oligarchs. You know, the people that are just on these lists, and they're issued by pretty much every country in the world, and also the United Nations have their own list, and we screen those as well. But the big problem with those is that the fines are huge if you get it wrong. You know, you can search on Google quite easily for you know, denied party fines, and some of these, you know, there's some very famous companies in America that operate as a platform, if you like, or a marketplace.
Yeah.
And not that long ago, they were fined $27 million for getting this wrong.
Wow.
So it's big fines. People don't realize it. Going into America, if you get something wrong, it's a over $300,000 per offense fine.
No way.
You ship three items to the wrong people, and that's three offenses. So each item is an offense.
Yeah. So with Hurricane Modular Commerce, are you basically taking all that pressure off people? But is that not a lot of pressure for you to get it exactly right as well? I mean, how much learning did you have to do? Because this seems like there's so many different branches to this tree. It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, we're lucky that, I mean, the people that we've got that were other founders were genuinely top of their tree,
yeah, right,
experts in their field. So the guy that looks after our compliance, which is this denied parties, prohibited and restricted tax and duties, Martin Palmer. Martin's ex-head of global compliance for TNT.
Wow.
You know, and he does a lot of consultancy with a lot of governments globally as well. So, you know, he is really three, top five globally of these people. So, you know, we do have the best of the best, yeah, like within Hurricane.
Yeah. Well, it seems that you can't really, you know, you couldn't really jump into this industry without, you know, knowing people that are incredibly well versed in it and have worked in this kind of thing for a long time.
And then the other area of things we do is what's called product classification. And so this is kind of another big thing at the moment. There's a lot of legislation that's coming in globally about making sure that goods that are being imported in a country are accompanied by a digital declaration. So in other words, there's a pre-advice comes in first, and it, you know, it'll have a description of the commodity, and then it'll need some codings against it. And one, you know, the classic one is a six-digit harmonized tariff code, which is a globally agreed identifier for a particular product. Mm. But then as you add more digits to the end, it becomes more finite in its description. So Right. Moving from t-shirt to cotton t-shirt to cotton poly t-shirt, yeah, as you add more digits. And the six digits are agreed globally, but then, you know, between each country has its own then 8 and 10 and even longer set of digits. And what we do is we do one of two things. We have a true AI classifier. So it's a deep learning natural language processing system. And it takes a description and it produces a classification.
Right.
Okay. It's quite an intensive. It's still quick on our side, but it's quite an intensive process. But it does give you a good classification. And we can also follow that up with enhanced manual cross-checking as well. So we've got a team of people which can kind of really ratify it. But then we have a new product which came out kind of middle of last year, which does similar thing. It does smart matching of cross-border goods. And it's designed to keep the world flowing, or keep the parcel world flowing.
Okay.
So it does a lot of different things. It gives you an indication of how good the existing data is. So in other words, if a customer provides a description and a tariff code, we'll let people know how good that is. Is it good? Is it right? Is it incorrect? Are there problems? We'll also then provide a corrected six-digit code if required. And we'll also then provide 10-digit import and export codes. And it's all done, you know, in about 100 milliseconds, so blink of an eye, literally blink of an eye stuff.
My gosh.
And we're pretty much the only people that can do it.
That's incredible. And there was one thought that came to me. So you've been, you know, Hurricane Modular Commerce started, was it, did you say 4 years ago?
Yeah, 2017.
So I just want to touch upon how the pandemic has affected, like, the postal service and all that kind of shipping and things like that. I mean, did you see a huge unexpected spike in business?
There was a drop to start off with.
Oh, really?
As you'd expect, you know, flights stopped for a while.
Things weren't
moving. You know, when it first kicked off, everyone shut their borders, they shut their airports. I mean, so just that, you know, freight wasn't moving around the world. It would, you know, we dropped to about 10% of our throughput that we'd been previously having. But then as the world opened up, then we've seen a steady growth. Mm. And, you know, there's all the reports you can go and find that are showing that, you know, it's the increase in the e-commerce market is growing, not quite exponentially, but it's growing at a much faster rate than it previously was.
Yeah.
And because of that, so the cross-border is, you know, cross-border is a subset. It's about 10% of the total e-commerce. So yes, and you know, we've seen we're now, you know, seeing higher figures now pro rata than we were before, just because, you know, people are more happier to order online and get it delivered to themselves, almost independent of where it came from.
Mm. It's interesting. It's really interesting. You know, we spoke the other week about kind of a few ideas around, you know, who you are as a person, the way you kind of mentally think about and, you know, tackle challenges. And one thing that came up was left field thinking. So we were saying taking inspiration from non-tech ideas and bringing them into the tech world. So I just want to kind of delve into that a little bit, if you could. And just, I mean, how does that philosophy kind of work in real terms?
I mean, a good example of that is the Zephyr product, the product we launched last year. Came about as a bit of a challenge from one of the European posts saying, you know, we know we can get to 10-digit and we know it's a two-stage process. We know that, you know, you can't really do it as a single page. And it kind of got me thinking about, well, is there a way we can get from a description to at least a suitable 10-digit? It may not be 100% accurate all the time, but is it good enough for the purpose that it's required? And I scratched my head. I had a couple of proof of concepts that were doing it as kind of like a two-step where we'd use our classifier to get a six-digit, and then we'd use another system to get to 10. And it was just sort of plaguing me that I couldn't get any further. And it was one of those things that I won't be proved wrong by people. My background is science. So my degree is physics. So I'm a physicist by passion, or scientist or engineer by passion. And I've applied that in robotics and satellites and all sorts of my career. And I have a habit of reading lots of different science journals and medical journals and all sorts. And I was reading very late one night a document or a research paper about finding genes within human DNA. And they were talking about some of the techniques they were using for that and how they were pattern matching. And it was one of those things that it kind of just sparked something. I blame in insomnia and caffeine, but something was triggered and it led me down a path of looking at some of these algorithms and then writing new ones. So I wrote a series of, it ended up being four, and we're about to go with another two because I've done some more work since then. So the next generation will actually come out with six algorithms, which are actually used to get from a customer's description to a six and 10 digit. I can't go into too much detail about this because, as I said, we're pretty much the only people that can do this. But from a biological research paper, I came up with a brand new product, and that's the product at the moment, which is getting a lot of the focus from us as a business. People are literally knocking on our door to get hold of this or be able to run it. And we're not talking, sort of small companies. We're talking about multi-billion dollar household name companies that are now, queuing up, if you like, to use this new product. So,
wow. That's crazy. I mean, do you think there's, obviously you've used physics there to kind of spawn this idea, but do you think, looking wider with technology and physics, do you think there's any kind of wider correlation there at all? Just as kind of a philosophical kind of question.
I think the problem that a lot of people have is that they're constrained by thinking within what they're used to.
Yeah.
So people think, well, we've got a particular solution, therefore we'll go and we'll look at libraries of IT solutions. We'll go and look at, a particular set of tools that are already available. And I've always never thought that way. Mm. I've never thought that we should be constrained by, the status quo of what we've got at the moment. I just don't see that. And I think this kind of comes from the work I did in the automotive industry to a certain degree. I got to know some of the designers for General Motors. And when you see the concept cars that come out, these are just not constrained by what's possible. Right. You look at them and they're really outlandish, and eventually they come out and perhaps they're not quite as, futuristic as people would hope for. But the initial design is genuinely just not constrained by what is currently possible. And I've kind of taken that into tech. Don't be constrained by what you think is or isn't possible, because it's only going to limit your opportunities to develop new solutions.
I was thinking also about, you see a lot of people now, or a lot of small businesses or startups kind of having these new technologies that they kind of think are going to change the world. But what you realize what they've done is they've created the tech and then they're trying to find a problem that it will solve.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So on that kind of wavelength, do you think, have you got any thoughts on letting innovation drive the tech rather than the other way around?
Yeah, without question. I mean, that's another one of my tenets is that you have to find the problem, not come up with some great idea and then look for a problem that it fixes. Mm. Because if you do that, you're probably going to miss what the actual problem is. You probably won't address it the way it should be addressed. And I think in the way you've got to do it is, look, find out what the problem is, and then don't be constrained in how you think of the solution or where the solution may come from. I genuinely believe that I've seen it a lot. I've seen it a lot during my consultancy time. I've seen a lot of companies that have got these fantastic ideas, but really there isn't a problem that is going to generate enough capital for them to actually be, you know, a viable business.
Yeah.
And you know, we were lucky with Hurricane, you know, to a certain extent. You know, with the other people that helped found it were, you know, ex-head of operations for DHL Global, for example. You know, we've got people that understand these, that the problems that exist, and the fact that there aren't really companies out there doing it to the full extent or as well or as accurately as it could be done. And we know from our own experience that, you know, we've had some very major household companies that we're still in talks with at the moment that have done blind tests on us. You know, we give people free open access to our solutions when they've signed NDAs, and we're kind of going down that route, because, you know, a lot of people go, oh, well, this is how our systems work, this is what they do. And you can tell people as much as you want, but unless they've actually got their hands on the solution, it's very difficult to for them to comprehend the impact it can have. And we know, for example, that, you know, we had a recent test done where, you know, we were twice as accurate as our nearest competitor. And this was blind test. We didn't even know the test was going on. We'd given them access, and they randomly go, oh, you know, you're twice as accurate as the next nearest people, which is a lovely position to be in.
Yeah.
And you know, we were there with a where there was a problem, and we stepped back, or I stepped back and looked at the problem and thought, well, how can we best address this? And we started off with just duties and taxes, you know, and we started off with just prohibited and restricted and denied parties, which are really just smart and, you know, semi-AI solutions. They're not, you know, not a full AI. And then, you know, we came up with our classification engine, then we came up with Zephyr, and we're addressing problems that our clients are having in new and unique ways, which are, you know, A, blisteringly quick. You know, that's the main tenet of what we do, is it's got to be real time. Mm. You know, we can't have something, you can't have a call that takes over a second. I mean, it's just no point. I mean, why would you do it? And we know solutions out there that are like that and longer still. It's got to be massively scalable, almost infinitely scalable. And then it's got to be massively cost effective. You know, so our clients don't mind that they're calling our API for every parcel that goes through, because what it's costing them is actually, in the big scheme of things, pretty much irrelevant on the cost of the parcel.
Well, I mean, would you say that, you know, you're massively ahead of the curve in this space?
That's always a very difficult thing, because I'm not kind of massively driven by ego, so always something I'm not a great one for, you know, bluster. But, you know, all I can say is from our clients. Yeah. You know, we've had feedback from, again, it's a postal service, but it's one of the biggest European postal services. It's a postal service that handles a lot of other European countries' posts inbound into Europe. So it comes into them, and then it gets distributed out. And we know from the local customs authorities there that the customs have told them directly that our solution is the most accurate solution they've ever seen.
Wow.
So, you know, we can take that, because it's something that's been said to us. You know, sales bluster is always that you're the best, you're the fastest, you're the most accurate. But we'd rather feedback what the real world tells us. And that was the latest one. That was only a few weeks ago that one of the largest customs, you know, governmental customs clearance in Europe has basically said that we're the best. So
cool. I mean, it's scaled as a business pretty quickly and continuously as well. So, I mean, how are you prepared for that scale, and how are you prepared for it going forward?
Again, we were really lucky. I mean, I've run, you know, big server clusters before. From the previous companies I worked for, one of the digital media companies, we had a massive server farm in downtown Los Angeles, at the bottom of Wilshire Boulevard. You know, we had 450 servers sitting in there doing work. It was mobile movies, working with all the major Hollywood studios, very rock and roll.
Yeah.
But it's a problem, because, you know, with e-commerce, it's very peaks and troughs. So you've got things like Black Friday and Christmas and Valentine's Day and New Year's sales, and then, you know, around Easter or Mother's Day. And, you know, there's certain peaks during the year, and the rest of the time it kind of just drifts along with a slight increase, as typically, you know, things, it tends to just grow by the natural course. So we took a very different approach 4 years ago, and we looked at the cloud-based services, but using something called a serverless architecture. So we don't actually have servers per se anywhere. We just buy raw processing power. And we went with AWS. I have a long history with Microsoft Azure. I was one of the very earliest adopters of it. Also been involved with Google Cloud way back when. But they didn't have all that we needed. I'll be honest, the way we were going to do things. And so we built ours on AWS. We built it, the technology we built it on give us massive, almost, you know, it's capacity that we'll never use. You know, our capabilities can go up so far. So, you know, typically on a node within a particular geographical region. So, you know, we have a node in China, we have a node in Ireland, we're just setting up an American one, an Australasian one. On each node, we've got a capacity roughly for our, you know, our duty and tax and prohibited, restricted and denied parties. We can process about 2.5 billion calls a month. That's with a B. For the Zephyr product, we're at about between 6 and 8 billion calls a month. You know, and that's per node. You know, so we're not going to worry. We're genuinely not going to worry if we've got a problem that, you know, we are running out of capacity on a node. It's a really nice problem to have. We'll just open another one up. If we've got a European problem that Ireland is creaking, we'll just open one up in London, or we'll open one up in Germany, or, you know, we'll just, and literally everything we've got now is all, it's all scripted, it's all automatic. So literally we're pointed at the new server, press a button, and within 6 hours we've got a new server run with that same capacity.
Unbelievable.
So yeah, we white papered everything, you know, it was a blank sheet of paper, and we architected it for this, for blistering throughput, you know, massive cost effectiveness, almost infinite scalability.
Just unbelievable. And do you think this would be possible without the use of the cloud?
No. Well, it would. It would just be very difficult. Again, you know, I've done it before with auto scaling. That there's things called Puppet or Chef, which allow you to kind of monitor what your server cluster is doing, and then it brings on more instances. And you could do it, but it would require virtualization. You know, if you were to go back to the old days of physically buying hardware, the amount of hardware you'd have to have in place to cope with the peaks would make it economically unviable for the normal points. And I think it's cloud driven, and more importantly, it's serverless that gives you this. You know, I think serverless has been one of the best moves forward in technology for a long, long time. You know, I think it can be key to success or failure within a company from a commercial point of view, because it's a really very, very cost-effective way of us running the business on the tech side. And it makes the cost per call to us tiny.
Yeah, it's incredible. It really is incredible. And look, Ian, I know you're such a busy guy. I mean, I can't believe you've managed to, you know, carve out even half an hour out of your day to speak to me. So I really do appreciate it, honestly. Yeah, it's been great. I've had a really, really good conversation. I've really enjoyed it. I mean, can we squeeze in one more question, do you think, before we go?
Yeah, absolutely.
I was just kind of thinking, obviously, you've had a really interesting career, and it's all seemed pretty fluid, but has there been any obstacle, or what's the biggest obstacle that you've come across that you've had to get over to get or overcome to get to your position right now?
I'd call it legacy thinking.
Right.
So it's people that are constrained by the way they think when they're viewing technology. I had it probably earlier in my career rather than later in my career, where I wanted to kind of push boundaries a bit more, and you kind of then are a bit more constrained about what you can and can't do, because you're just, you know, you're a systems manager rather than being, you know, a director or a CTO. So it's a little bit more constrained. And I think it's particularly where you're moving into the unknown. So, you know, fortunately, as I said, with Hurricane, the 5-6 of us that founded the company, we'd all worked with each other before, not together, but, you know, within a matrix of we worked with each other. So therefore we kind of already implicitly trusted each other. So when I said, okay, we're going to go serverless, we're going to use this new technology, we're going to go with an architecture that currently we know no one else is using, because Amazon didn't have it anywhere in their documentation about what we were going to do. Interestingly, it appeared about 6 months after we'd actually deployed it. It was one of their suggestions for deployment, which is, you know, again, we weren't responsible for that. I have to say, you know, Amazon weren't aware we were on their radar. They are now, and we get a lot of help from them. But I think it's breaking through the barriers of what people are comfortable with, you know, and that has been a problem previously, less so in the last 15 years or so, because I almost have a bit of a history of it, you know, that I've a history of delivering against what I've said what I'm going to do. And I think that's it. It's breaking down those barriers of where people are constrained by what they believe is possible.
Yeah, amazing. And that's such good advice as well for, you know, people in the industry. I'd like to think that, you know, people would hear this and then, you know, have a second think about the way they're going to tackle a problem, maybe, or like.
And I do think, you know, if people can be less constrained by what they believe is possible and kind of think about how would I like to do this and see whether they can do it.
Yeah.
Rather than think, oh, this is the technology that's available, we'll use this. You know, think about what the problem is and how they'd like to solve it. And then see if the solution, they can actually make the technology fit the solution. If not, can they develop the technology that fits the solution?
Yeah, definitely. It seems like such a, you know, such a more kind of innovative way to, you know, create technology. It absolutely does. And it just seems so right. You know, when you say it that way, you kind of think that is exactly how technology should be viewed, like unconstrained, you know. It's there to be played with.
It is. I mean, there are some great, you know, great people, companies out there doing it. You know, you look at, you know, even some of the big names like Tesla, you know, that guy's not constrained.
Yeah, that's
Elon
true.
Musk, not, but for all his, you know, I'm not going to say flaws, but for all his idiosyncrasies, you know, the guy's not constrained by what he thinks he can and can't do.
Yeah,
you know,
and
there's, you know, there is a history of it. There's a history of it within, you know, big companies and small companies. But I think, you know, the more we can do, you know, the more tech gets pushed forward, you know, because it becomes not catch 22, but it becomes a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. If you're pushing at tech, then, you know, tech will evolve to meet what you require. And I think that the way we move forward and we get better is a not being constrained.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really nice point to end on as well, actually, and if that's right with you. Thanks so much for taking the time to do this. Honestly, I've really enjoyed it. And as I mentioned before, I know you're an incredibly busy guy, so I really appreciate you taking the time. And yeah, I'm sure a lot of the listeners will get a lot from this. So yeah, thanks once again.
No problem, my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform.